You know, it is funny how we usually think about communication.
Oh, how so?
Well, like if you have something really important to say, you know, something heavy, the standard advice is to be as literal as possible.
Right, just say the words.
Exactly. Just
Yeah.
say the words, show the photograph, make it plain. But then you have these moments where reality is just, I mean, it is too big or too painful or maybe just too chaotic to be captured by a straight photograph or a simple sentence.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it got me thinking. How can spilling a bucket of paint onto a blank canvas or painting a brick house that slowly morphs into a human face somehow communicate the most profound realities of war or memory or urban chaos better than a literal description ever could?
It is a great question, and it really gets to the heart of what we are doing today. Because for contemporary artist Joyeux Duc, paint isn't just a medium to recreate an image.
Right.
It is an active territory where the visible world is forced into a dialogue with the symbolic world.
And we are exploring this through his own words today, right?
Yeah, we are. We are looking at excerpts from his book, Tractatio Pittura Artistica, specifically diving into the chapter titled Surrealismo y Abstraccion. And he gives us the blueprint to his own mind right there.
Which is so rare for an artist to lay out so clearly.
It really is. He establishes a core philosophy right out of the gate. He says he plays with color, with forms, and with the physical matter of the paint itself, but he never renounces the underlying meaning or the message.
So it is never just abstract for the sake of being pretty.
Exactly. Emotion, memory, and even ethical postures are literally inscribed onto the surface of his canvas.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit, because it sounds like the canvas is essentially acting as a translator.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, like on one side you have these raw, unspoken emotions or these massive global realities, and on the other side you have the physical world of the viewer, you know, standing in the gallery.
Right, the person actually taking it in.
And Duke is using surrealism and abstraction as the translation languages between those two worlds.
That is a perfect way to put it. And he applies this translation language to some incredibly intense global realities first, which brings us to his series titled Homes and Faces or Casas y Rostros.
Ah, yes, this series is
It
intense.
really is. Here we see surrealism functioning as an incredibly direct, almost blunt tool.
And just for anyone studying art, this is a great example to compare styles. With surrealism, unlike pure abstraction, the recognizable objects are still there.
Exactly. The human faces and the architecture in these paintings are still very clear, but they amalgamate.
They sort of melt into each other.
Yeah, they merge together to narrate the drama of desolation, loss and violence.
The way he describes the imagery in this series is honestly haunting. Like, the houses literally become bodies and the faces become ruins.
It is very heavy.
It is. The painting itself becomes a space of memory, of denunciation, and of resistance. And the text gets very specific about what realities he is confronting here.
Right, so Duke explicitly states in the text that these specific pieces transmit a direct message against the genocide in Gaza.
And just to be clear for the listeners, we are reporting on this strictly from the angle of his stated intent as the artist to understand the source material.
Exactly. We are looking strictly at how he uses his art to communicate his stated position. We see him refusing to elude what he feels is his responsibility as an artist in the face of human suffering.
He is using the architecture itself as a stand-in for the human toll.
He is.
I am looking at the mechanics of this, though, and I have to ask about the efficacy for the viewer.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, does merging a brick wall with a human cheekbone actually make the violence feel more visceral than, say, a standard high-definition photograph on the evening news?
Oh, that is a really interesting point.
Because, I mean, we see literal images of destroyed houses on the news every single day, and they are objectively horrifying. So why paint it?
What's fascinating here is the psychological mechanism of surrealism. That is what makes this approach so powerful.
How so?
Well, when you watch the evening news, your brain naturally categorizes a photograph of a ruined building as an external objective fact.
Right, it is a thing happening over there.
Exactly. It is terrible, but it is a literal object in a distant place. Your brain actually has defensive layers built up to process that kind of literal photographic
What?
trauma so you can function.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes total sense. We are so desensitized to it.
Right, but when an artist warps reality, When a house is bleeding or when a human face is crumbling into a pile of structural rubble, it bypasses that logical categorization.
It sneaks past the defenses.
Yes, it creates cognitive dissonance. It forces you to process the horror emotionally rather than logically.
You aren't just looking at a destroyed building anymore.
No, you are feeling the destruction of the human soul that lived inside it, because the two are visually indistinguishable on the canvas.
It makes the architecture human and the human architectural. You literally can't look away from the human cost because the building is the human.
Exactly.
It completely redefines what we think of when we hear the word surrealism. I mean, we usually associate the term with, you know, painting melting clocks or weird subconscious dreamscapes.
Yeah, right, the Salvador Dali kind of stuff.
Yeah. But here, Duke is using surrealism as a tool for visceral, objective truth. He takes recognizable forms and violates their physical laws to reflect a reality where the ethical laws have already been violated.
That is beautifully said. And if surrealism is how he handles the harsh, objective reality of the present, we really have to look at what happens when he turns that lens inward to the past.
Right, moving from the external to the internal.
Because he can't use those same heavy amalgamated brick lines for a fading memory. It just wouldn't work. The source text shows a very distinct shift when he moves from the physical weight of war to the elusive nature of memory.
And this is in his series called Homes In, right?
Yes, the Homes In series.
He moves into the aneric here, which is basically relying entirely on the logic of dreams and evocation.
He focuses on fragments of neighborhoods, memories of places that marked him personally.
He actually refers to the images that remain in his mind as emotional footprints, which is such a great phrase.
It is. And he gives a very specific example in the text regarding a piece that references Plaka, a neighborhood in Greece.
Oh, right, the Greece piece.
The technical shift here is profound. Like we said, for the harsh reality of war, he used surrealism. The forms were distorted but still recognizable as faces and houses.
But for the memory of Greece, he leans heavily into abstraction.
Completely. The painting no longer seeks visual fidelity with reality at all. It is not trying to be a visual document of a Mediterranean street.
The physical, geographical site of Plaka melts away entirely. Like, it stops being a place on a map and becomes an atmosphere.
Yes, exactly.
He says it is translated into watercolor as a personal echo. And the medium he chooses here, you know, watercolor, is just the perfect mechanical metaphor for this process.
Oh, because of how watercolor behaves on the page.
Yeah, watercolor is fundamentally a wet, uncontrollable medium. It bleeds into the fibers of the paper, it is translucent, and it sort of fades as it dries.
That is such a good point. The physics of watercolor literally mirror the neurology of memory. When water binds to the paper, the edges blur, much like how our synapses lose the hard edges of a memory over time.
An abstract watercolor gives you the emotional footprint of a place.
You don't remember the exact number of windows on the building in Greece, but you remember the atmosphere.
You remember how the light felt, or the echo of the street.
Yeah, right.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. It is the difference between looking at a Google Maps street view of a neighborhood versus the fading emotional feeling you get when you try to remember a place you visited 10 years ago.
A Google map gives you absolute visual fidelity, but zero emotional resonance.
Exactly. But then right after exploring this fading, delicate memory of Greece through translucent watercolor, the source text introduces a totally different kind of urban memory.
Oh, you mean the Cali piece?
Yes. We get to a piece called La Calle del Sabor, or the Street of Flavor, in Cali, Colombia. And suddenly, we are back in the realm of surrealism, characterized by this really distorted and vibrant figuration.
It is a total shift in tone.
It is an immersion into the literal entrails, like the core of the Street of Flavor.
And this shows how, for Duke, the style is dictated by the energy of the memory itself.
What do you mean?
Well, the Street of Flavor in Cali is a sensory overload. It is rhythm, it is music, it is heat.
Right.
Soft, bleeding watercolors couldn't possibly carry the weight of that kind of intense memory.
They would be too quiet.
Exactly. So distorting the figures through vibrant surrealism allows him to paint the actual rhythm of the street, not just the physical people standing on it.
Oh, wow.
It captures a festive energy that borders on the chaotic and the poetic. The distortion is mechanically necessary to capture the sheer volume of the experience.
It is essentially synesthesia on canvas.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to paint sound, heat, and movement.
That is a brilliant way to describe it.
So we have seen him tightly control the narrative of war with those amalgamated faces. and we have seen him carefully shape the narrative of memory with those watercolor atmospheres and vibrant distortion.
Right.
But the final stage discussed in this chapter is where I am really struggling to reconcile his methodology.
Okay, the acrylics.
Yeah. This is where he moves to a series of acrylics based on vertidos, which are pourings or spillings of paint directly onto the canvas.
Right. He explores an almost total material freedom here. He plays with the water, the pigment, the physical support of the canvas, and gravity itself.
He allows the forms to emerge organically from the fluid dynamics of the acrylic.
Yes.
But if he is just letting gravity and water do whatever they want, how is this still art with a message?
It seems like a contradiction, right?
Yeah. I mean, doesn't it just become a random, pretty mess? We started this entire discussion by establishing that he rigorously controls the canvas to protest war, and that he never renounces meaning.
That is true.
So where is the meaning when you just hand the steering wheel over to the physical materials?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the meaning isn't lost at all. It has just migrated into the physical action itself.
Okay, keep going.
The gesture, the stain, and the flow of the color become their own distinct language. The organic emergence of these forms speaks for itself because the physical matter of the world is expressing itself.
So he isn't forcing the paint to be a face or a house anymore.
Exactly. The unpredictability of the liquid paint is the point. He is letting the subconscious and the material world collaborate.
But he does ground that wild, chaotic freedom with something incredibly specific, though.
The titles.
Yes. Even though the compositions seem entirely driven by chance, he links them nostalgically to the titles. He names these poured pieces after towns in the Valle del Cauca in Colombia.
And that connection is so crucial, it anchors the abstraction back to the real world.
Right.
You might be looking at this wild explosion of poured acrylic driven entirely by fluid dynamics and gravity, but the title forces you to connect this free-flowing matter to the memory of a specific territory.
It grounds it.
It does. And this actually brings us to the title of the book itself and a concept it really emphasizes, which is trastio.
Right. So trastio translates to a move, like shifting your belongings from one house to another. It's a physical displacement.
Exactly. He describes this acrylic series as a trastio driven by matter, by chance, and by the memory of the territory.
So it is like a physical and emotional moving of internal furniture.
That is a great visual. The landscape of our homeland isn't static, right? And our memory of it certainly isn't static.
No, it shifts and changes.
So the paint used to represent it can't be statically applied with a rigid brush. The liquid paint spreading across the canvas mimics the shifting, unpredictable ways we hold on to the physical land we grew up on.
That makes so much sense. Taking a step back and looking at this entire chapter, the way Duke synthesizes all of these different approaches is just remarkable.
It really is a cohesive vision.
The text concludes with a synthesis that ties the heavy surrealism of war, the abstract watercolors of Greece, and the free-flowing acrylics of Colombia altogether.
Yes. Duke states that this entire exploration of surrealism and abstraction represents a continuous displacement.
A continuous displacement.
Right. It is a constant transit between form and emotion, between memory and physical matter, and between plastic freedom, like, you know, letting the paint do what it wants, and symbolic responsibility, ensuring the art still speaks to human realities.
It is a trastio not just of physical paint, but a movement through ideas, through pigments, and through the literal footprints that the world prints onto his gaze.
It is incredibly profound.
It really is, and I feel like it completely reframes the way you should interact with this kind of art. Like the next time you find yourself standing in a gallery looking at a piece of surrealism or deep abstraction, the question shouldn't be, what is this a picture of?
Oh, definitely not.
You shouldn't be looking for the high-fidelity Google Maps version of reality.
The question should be, what emotional footprint is this artist leaving behind?
Yes.
Are they amalgamating recognizable forms to force cognitive dissonance and make you feel a harsh truth? Or are they using translucent watercolor to mimic the neurological fading of a memory?
Or are they pouring acrylic to let the chaotic energy of a specific place speak for itself through fluid dynamics?
Exactly. The art is just a reflection of the traces the world leaves on the artist's mind, translated into physical matter.
Abstraction isn't the absence of reality. It is often the only way to capture a reality that is too big or too messy for literal lines.
I could not agree more.
It is the translation of the invisible emotional weight into the visible physical world. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I really want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We have spent this time exploring how Jairo Duke translates his internal world and external trauma onto the canvas. But what about yours?
Oh, I like where this is going.
If you had to paint your most defining memory right now, how would you approach the canvas?
Would you use the structured, vibrant distortion of surrealism to show the sensory chaos of the moment?
Right. Or would you pour the paint, step back, and let gravity, fluid dynamics, and chance take over the narrative? What footprints is the world leaving on your gaze today?
That is a question that completely changes how you look at both art and your own memory.
It really does. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the fascinating mind of Jairo Duque. We hope it gave you a whole new lens to look through.
Mm-hmm.
Until next time, keep exploring.